Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's Forum program, the Transcontinental Railroad has been dubbed a spectacular feat of 19th century engineering and has been credited with opening California up to trade. Despite the importance of the project, little is known about the individual lives of the 12,000 Chinese immigrants who laid the track between Sacramento and the Sierra Nevada. Now, 150 years after Chinese workers began working on the railroad, we look back on the contributions of those workers and we learn about the Stanford Project that is piecing together their personal stories. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. This is the second hour of this morning's program. An international project is underway at Stanford, the most exhaustive research project ever related to Chinese railroad workers, led by history professor Gordon Chang and English professor Shelley Fisher Fishkin. The study is focused on the crucial role of thousands of Chinese workers in the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, including the role they played in helping to create the fortune which led to the founding of Stanford University by Leland Stanford, and their contribution in shaping the physical and social landscape of the West. The role of these laborers was until recently long ignored or simply not given appropriate recognition, and this project concerns itself with discovering, as much as it is possible to do so, who they were and the lives they lived and who they and their descendants were destined to become. Joining us for the discussion this morning here in studio is Gordon Chang, professor of history and humanities and director of the Center for East Asian Studies at Stanford and co-director of the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project. Gordon Chang, good to have you back on Forum.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And we also have Sue Lee with us in studio. She's the executive director of the Chinese Historical Society of America. Sue Lee, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you. And Russell Lowe is with us by phone this morning. He's a descendant of a Chinese railroad worker. Good to have you, Russell Lowe. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning to you. And let me begin with Professor Chang. Gordon Chang, as I said, is here with us in studio. And seems appropriate that the study would come out of Stanford with Leland Stanford. But you want to find out, as I understand it, how these people lived, how they survived, what kind of lives they had. And it's been pretty elusive. There isn't that much of a record. I mean, usually you go to memoirs or you go to diaries or you go to letters. And I know you're working with the Chinese themselves in Chinese historical scholars in China. But it's been challenging, hasn't it?
It has. But let me just say something about the appropriateness of this project being at Stanford. The Dean of Humanities and Sciences at Stanford just a couple of weeks ago, for the first time as an official university, acknowledged the role of the workers in building the wealth of Leland Stanford, you know, who then transferred the wealth to become Stanford University. So the project is really appropriate to be there. And we still don't have a monument. We don't have anything at Stanford that acknowledges the workers' contributions formally.
Well, that was going on a long time in the United States. At Promontory Point, where the Golden Spike was, I guess in 1969, when you hit the 100th anniversary, there was no recognition. And in fact, we can talk about that some more with Sue Lee, but this has been a long time coming.
Yes, it has. And that's what sort of prompted the project. Many of us have been interested in the railroad workers. I grew up in Oakland, and I was always interested about the railroad workers, but knew virtually nothing about them. We knew I had about one sentence in textbooks. There were Chinese railroad workers who helped build the Transcontinental Line, and period, end of sentence. But we didn't know anything, as you said, about their identities, what kind of work they did, how they lived, how they died, where they came from, what happened to them. And the project seeks to recover that history.
And it's not necessarily a lost history, but it's a history that's, I know, challenging, as I've said, and difficult to recover. We're talking about a history that has a lot to do with the making of the West, with building roads as well as the Transcontinental Railroad. When we're talking about Chinese labor, about building the infrastructure and so forth, there's just so much other than that one sentence that's in so many history books where kids learn, yes, it was the Chinese on the backs of Chinese labor that managed to build that railroad. Many of these early Chinese who came here, though, were from the Pearl River Delta area around Canton.
That's right. And they came over following – some began to come over in some numbers following the gold rush in 1849 and were here for a decade or so. And then the railroad began in the 1860s. And the early Chinese workers on that railroad were former miners, others who were already in California. Later on, they were recruited to come from – directly from China to work on the railroad.
Little of their voices, though. I guess in part it's hard to keep records when you're working up in the Sierras.
Yeah. Well, one of the extraordinary matters is, and the great challenge we face, is that we, even though we're trying to recover their lived experience, we have absolutely nothing, not one single document in their own hand. They left no records that we have today about their experience in their own voice. Not a diary, not a letter back home, not a memoir, not even oral history years later that was taken that has survived. So we think this material certainly existed at one time, but we can't find it now.
So getting at this material, I mean, like I said, you've been working. This is a joint project with scholars in China. You've got, I believe, in fact, come April next year, the Chinese scholars and North American scholars are going to convene and meet at Stanford, and you're going to get a digital archive launched?
Yes, we have a academic conference, a large international conference scheduled for next year, and we'll have scholars from Taiwan, Hong Kong, China, Canada. And we will gather together to share our research. We have over 100 scholars involved with our project. The amazing thing is that the scholars in China have also been scouring archives and libraries and homes there, and they too have not found a single letter from a Chinese railroad worker back in China. Now, why is that so? Were they simply illiterate and didn't say anything or didn't write anything? But we know that's not true. Many of them were literate, and many of them did send materials back home, including remittances and even, we think, found objects such as hammers or spikes and this type of thing, the sort of memorabilia that they sent back, but not a piece of paper that describes their lived experience.
Makes it difficult and challenging. Gordon Chang, again, is professor of history and humanities and directs the Center for East Asian Studies at Stanford. He also co-directs the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project. And Su Li is executive director of the Chinese Historical Society of America. Let's talk with you, Su Li, about why this is so important. I mean, I said most of these laborers came from near Canton, but it seems to be important to everybody of Chinese descent, and perhaps one could argue, and I believe you do, to Americans.
It absolutely is important. A little bit about the Chinese Historical Society. We are the oldest historical society in the country, presenting the social, political, and cultural history of Chinese in America. And the story of working of the railroad is really a linchpin, a cornerstone of Chinese-American history. Yet, as Professor Chang just said, we know very little about the details of those stories. Yet we know there are families descended from these humble railroad workers. And so as Stanford launches its project and as we partner with them, we are really focused on those descendant families because we know that within those families, there's been an oral tradition passed down, no documents necessarily, maybe some heirlooms, some artifacts, but no documents. So we want those stories. And
of course,
those
the stories,
that history alive.
Through a century and a half, the stories take on some myth and confabulation and all the rest of that.
Absolutely, just like the stories of other immigrant families in the U.S. If you were a descendant of the Mayflower, of somebody who came over the Mayflower, or you came through Ellis Island, that's something that your family is very proud of and you talk about. We don't have that tradition in the Chinese-American community. We don't talk about our early ancestors, and I think it's about time. So this project is very timely. The convergence of the project with the actual induction of ceremony at the Department of Labor, which recognized the work of Chinese laborers on the railroad last year, really converged and inspired people to begin digging into our own history.
But that was after what I alluded before to I don't know how to describe it except as a snub when the Golden Spike 100-year anniversary stuff went on. In fact, I think some Chinese Americans thought they were going to be involved, and they weren't.
Actually, the Historical Society spent a lot of time in 1969 raising money to make sure, to try to ensure that Chinese railroad workers would be honored or recognized at the centennial celebration at Promontory. In fact, our president was invited to the ceremony but was abruptly left off the program because John Wayne was there along with four senators and a number of other celebrities. And so again, the Chinese were snubbed. But at that time in 1969, think about how many Chinese were in the U.S. You know, the Immigration Naturalization Act had just was signed in 1965, 50 years ago. The immigration was opening up. And so there were so few Chinese in the U.S. that people felt that it was okay to snub this small group of people. Today, we're numbering, you know, in the 4 million, 6 million range. And so there's much more awareness of the diversity of these early pioneers who helped build the country, and so there's more interest and in recognizing them,
and more of an importance to really try to bring their lives into some kind of focus or understanding, especially when it comes to education. And by the way, we've posted a few images from the Chinese Railroad and North America Project and a video with more information about it on our website, kqed.org/forum. The images give you a sense of just how difficult and dangerous this work was. And let's talk about that with you, Sue Lee. I mean, I was reading about the summit tunnel. It took two winters just to get through the granite. And we're talking about use of hand tools. We're talking about, you know, blasting, dangerous work too. I mean, in addition to being so onerous and laborious, it was just really perilous.
It's almost unimaginable that the Central Pacific was able to blast through the Sierra Nevadas in 2 years. And the reason they were able to do that was they had this terrific labor pool of Chinese who used hand tools, who used blasting powder, who used dynamite, and they were lucky to be able to blast through that granite at the rate of an inch a day or foot a day. And so to build, I think it was 15 tunnels, Professor Chang can correct me,
and also
the Sierra Nevada, through the mountains.
To build one of the most extraordinary things of the 19th century.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, without any doubt about that. There's also a stigma of these paper sons, isn't there?
Well, they didn't become paper sons until after the 1882 Exclusion Act. So before the Exclusion Act, these Chinese who came to work on the railroad, there was no exclusion. There was a lot of discrimination. There was a lot of violence against the Chinese, but the laws to bar immigration weren't in place yet.
Again, Sue Lee here in studio is Executive Director of the Chinese Historical Society of America. Russell Lowe is a descendant of a Chinese railroad worker. He's with us by phone. You knew growing up your great-grandfather worked on the railroad, Russell?
Well, I did, and my great-grandfather's name was Hung Lai Wo. His actually given name was Hung Poi. And in our family, it was always part of the oral history that he worked on the railroad, and no one was very specific. And I think that's part of the problem here is that the Transcontinental Railroad is significance that we give to it now and historians give to it. For the Chinese, it was a job they had. I'm sure it's a job they took pride in, but knowing that it was the Transcontinental Railroad probably wasn't in their consciousness. Now, he came from a village called Dai Long Village, which is in Toishan. And the oral history that we learned much later was that he came with a brother. He was a teenager. In fact, 50% of these young men were simply teenagers. He came probably about 1865. He worked on the Transcontinental Railroad. And interestingly, according to his son, his uncle, the brother, lost an eye in one of the blasting accidents. So this was a very, very dangerous job. Now, why we came to know this actually is a very compelling part of the story. It turns out that the son, Uncle Kim, lived to be 100 years of age. And at his 100th birthday party, they actually recorded on videotape his spontaneous, unprepared remarks where he's talking about the Central Pacific Railroad, and he's talking about his father and his uncle and how they came to work on the railroad. So we really were able to preserve that, not only for our family, but really for posterity.
Well, you got involved in this, I believe, going to the Railroad Museum, didn't you?
That's absolutely right. I was talking to my wife yesterday about this, and it turns out that, you know, I knew about this videotape. I'd seen it. I had had a history, interest in our family history for, you know, a couple of decades now. But I took my parents there because of that interest, and we were looking in one of the display cases, and we saw one of the Central Pacific Railroad payroll sheets. It was actually from 1865, and I was shocked to see his name, or a name very similar to his, on that railroad sheet. It actually said Hung Wah. And these names, it turns out, are very specific to the family and to the village and to the generation. So his village of Dai Long, everybody in that village had the same family name of Hong. And everybody of his generation, all the men, had the generation name of Hua. So Hung Hua was either my great-grandfather or brother or one of the young men from his village.
So when you learned about this history, you learned about it to some extent growing up, but when you did more research on it, when you became more engaged with it and involved with it, discovering that your family had a connection to these 2,000 miles of railroad with the hand tools and the blasting powder and all the rest of it, did that give you a sense of pride, a sense of ownership?
Yeah. Absolute sense of pride, and it's a pride that I've passed on to my children and my nephews and cousins. It's something that we own in a sense. You know, the story of the Transcontinental Railroad really is our story, and I think it is a source of pride. I've gone up to the Great Summit Tunnel with my sons and seen it in the summer. It's just a spectacular experience. I sort of feel connected to these ancestors. And more recently, last winter, I was up there with my son Ryan, and we saw it in the dead of winter at night, and there's ice and snow, and we had sort of a sense of what it must have been like for these men in those very, very cold, harsh winters of 1866 and 1867.
It's, I think, safe to say, Sue Lee, that this sounds like when I phrase it this way, I know to some people's hearing like hyperbole, but the West was built on the back of Chinese labor. I mean, in addition to enduring things that you mentioned, like hardship and persecution.
Well, the West was wide open. There was a need to build the country, and Chinese labor was more available. It was quicker to come from China on a clipper ship than it was to get across the country from the east. That was one of the compelling reasons to build a transcontinental railroad. But in the meantime, how would you build the American West? How would you reclaim land? How would you...
Well, the whole infrastructure, too.
Absolutely. And so Chinese labor was used everywhere.
And some of these people we're talking about, these laborers, Gordon Chang, came from, as I said, you've been working with Chinese scholars as well. Some of these places in China came to be known as railroad villages?
Sure. Some of the home villages of these workers generated scores of these workers. And it's sort of a pattern established where they would leave these villages in the Pearl River Delta, these small little villages not far away from Hong Kong and Macau, and take the ship across the ocean to get to the United States. As Sue was saying, it took many times less time to get from Hong Kong or Macau to get to San Francisco than get from New York to San Francisco, because at that time, before the Transcontinental, you had to take a ship from New York, maybe stop in Panama, and then take your take a trek across the isthmus, or go all the way around the tip of South America and come all the way around. It would take months, and so the Chinese were available labor force. And I also have to say that the Chinese were fundamental in building the infrastructure of the West, but beyond. One of the things we found in the project is that yes, the Chinese were 80% of the labor force on the Central Pacific Railroad. But after the conclusion of the construction in 1869, they went on and became, in a sense, professional railroad workers throughout the Western Hemisphere. They went to Canada. They went to Montana. They went to the East Coast. They went to the South. They went to South America, Mexico. There were hundreds and thousands of these Chinese who were now skilled railroad workers who helped build the infrastructure of the Western Hemisphere. And then
many of them became merchants as well.
Especially the labor contractors, such as Russell's ancestor. It was very interesting that there is a class differentiation among them. They weren't just all hard backs and strong arms, but they were merchants, they were doctors, they were cooks, they were all sorts of – had different skills. And many of them did return to China too, where they helped fund these villages, these railroad villages. And also help start up the early Chinese railroad industry itself, so that this experience of the Transcontinental Line has significance way beyond the line from Sacramento to Promontory Point.
What about let's get to the line a little bit from a historian standpoint? I mean, you do have some we talk about paper sons, and that came later, but the difficulty in documentation and the paper trail, where do you begin to search? How do you find the papers that are necessary to even give you a clue to who these people were?
We looked at traditional sources, such as libraries, Bancroft Library, the Stanford Library, the Railroad Museum Library, different other repositories around the West, and we're still looking in manuscript collections. We sent the word out to colleagues and historians around the country to help us locate any material, but we still haven't found that material. So then we threw out the net further. We worked with – we were working with the Historical Society and descendants such as Russell to get the word out. And here I do want to make a shout out here to any person who may know of any material to please let us know about it. We hope that maybe some of the descendants' families would have documents, but so far nothing.
I think you'll get some response from our listeners.
That'd
know we'll
great.
Get some when we invite listeners to call or email us. It's a big Chinese community throughout the Bay Area, and a lot of people are just really, Sue Lee, is it too much to say, passionately interested in this whole subject? Yeah?
They are, because it's about them. It's about being Chinese American. It's about being part of the American historical narrative. It's about contributing to this country. It's such a huge story. But to add on to what Gordon said in terms of documentation, when you look at how the Chinese worked on the railroad, they worked in crews, and they were supervised by a white foreman. And they had crews of 30 or so, and they had a cook for each crew. So when you think about 12,000 Chinese workers, and you divide by 30, think about the number of Chinese cooks, you know? And there's a storyline here about the Chinese cooks that went on into other they were cooks on ranches. They were cooks of wealthy families. They were cooks all over the West.
A few of them managed to start restaurants too, right?
Exactly. And when you think about those white foremen, there may be a chance that somebody kept a diary about the crew that they supervised or the crews that they supervised, and there may have been friendships developed or snippets in those kinds of diaries about a Chinese who worked on a crew.
There's a lot in this whole project that speaks to the need for not only discovering the past and discovering identity and all that, but also the importance of recognition of a real integral role that's been played. And I would add to that sense of justice.
Justice is very important.
How
you
so?
Know, some of us,
from your perspective,
some of us, you know, who grew up, came of age during the civil rights movement and then the war movement and, you know, ethnic studies strike at San Francisco State, feel very strongly about our story being overlooked. And so we're taking control in a way by recovering the stories and telling the stories in our own voice, telling the stories through the Russell Lowe's of the world, through the Connie Young Hughes of the world.
Well, I'd like to hear from listeners on this. Some of you may have some stories to add from your own personal family experience or from the history, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and foreman that Sue Lee mentioned, but also questions or comments about some of the bigger questions we're dealing with here in the Stanford Project, unearthing personal histories of Chinese railroad workers and what that means to rediscover and to go back and to really put some of those pieces together. Our toll-free number, you can join us now, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. We also welcome your emails. The email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can go online with your questions or comments, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The Transcontinental Railroad has been dubbed a feat of 19th century engineering, has been credited with opening California up to trade, and despite the importance of the project, little is known about the individual lives of the some 12,000 Chinese immigrants who laid the track between Sacramento and the Sierra Nevada. And 150 years after Chinese laborers began construction on the railroad, we're looking back on the contributions of those workers, learning about the Stanford Project that is piecing together their personal stories. And there's a partnership between Stanford and the Chinese Historical Society of America. Gordon Chang is with us. He co-directs the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project. And Sue Lee is executive director director of the Chinese Historical Society of America. I also have Russell Lowe on the line, a descendant of a Chinese railroad worker. And if people do have some information for either of you, let's give out information about how they can best get in touch with you or forward it to your
our website. The Chinese Historical Society of America has a website, chsa.org. We have a project called Work of Giants, which is part of this project. And we have video interviews and documentation of these stories already online. And we'd love to add to it. So if anybody has any information, please get in touch with us.
And the phrase I was flailing around for some reason, Gordon Chang, to bring it to your attention. How can people do that?
The project has a website as well. The easiest way to get to that is to do a search for Chinese Railroad Workers Stanford, and you'll get the link. And at that site, we do have images of the railroad workers, historical images. We have samples of documents that we have from the Central Pacific Railroad, such as the payroll records, letters from principals such as Collis Huntington or Leland Stanford. And we do have video of interviews with some of the descendants. So we really do hope people will reach us, get in touch with us with their information. This is the new age now where we do sort of a cloud sourcing and get information from everywhere.
Well, and as I said earlier, we've posted a few images from the Chinese Railroad North America Project and a video with more information about it. It's on our website, kqed.org/forum, and the images really give you a sense of just how difficult and dangerous the work was. A few listeners are asking this question. How were the workers supervised and directed in their jobs? What language was used? Were the foremen bilingual?
Our information, and again, Professor Chang can correct us, is that the Chinese workers worked in teams of about 30 men supervised by a white foreman. There were translators as well. The crews spoke primarily Cantonese, probably the Toisan or Seyup, Liyip dialect of Cantonese. And they were paid about $30 a month. That did not include their food. Each crew had their own cook. They ate Chinese food during this work. And so all that has been pretty much documented by journalists of the day because they would visit the work sites and investigate how the Chinese crews were living. But there's a lot more detail that we need to find out about, and that's what this project is about.
Well, here's another question about maybe some of those details that you can inform us about. How were the workers recruited? Was this a desirable job opportunity for Chinese men? And how were they well paid? Also, the same listener wants to know, what was the significance of the ponytail hairstyle?
Well, the hairstyle was called the queue, right. A long tail in the back, which was a required hairstyle by the imperial government in China. And all Chinese men had to wear that. If they didn't, that would be a sign that they were a rebel, and that could be mortal for their own fate if they were caught by the imperial authority. So over here, you do see Chinese with the queue, but also some without the queue. They came from a very relatively small area of southern China, as Sue mentioned, and many of them were related. The early workers were already here and were recruited to go up to the Sierras. We have newspaper ads showing advertising the kind of work that was available. And then later on, the railroad company sent recruiters to China to try to recruit more workers directly from China.
The listener wants to know, was it considered a desirable job, and do we know how they were what they were paid, the amount that they were paid?
Well, the work was desirable in that it was employment. There was always difficulty finding good employment in California, and certainly many Chinese young men sought their fortunes to leave China to come to the United States, but also Canada, Cuba, Peru, and other places. But coming to California was more desirable than going to other sites for various reasons. But the work was very, very difficult and deadly, as you pointed out earlier. In 1867, the 2,000 to 3,000 Chinese workers up there on the line went on strike. And this is really a story which very few people know about. It was one of the largest labor strikes at the time, We wonder how this was coordinated way up in the Sierras. You have thousands of these workers who didn't speak English and didn't have ways of communicating the way we do today, obviously, or even back then, of how they were able to have this coordinated strike, put down their tools, and stop work.
Listener Mike says, didn't some workers abandon the job to try their luck in the gold fields, or was it the other way around?
It was the other way around. They came from the gold fields. And then because the work of the railroad work was dependable, reliable, the railroad, the Central Pacific needed the laborers. The work was there. It was estimated that the Central Pacific needed 5,000 workers. And they initially tried all kinds of other types of workers, not Chinese. They didn't want Chinese because they felt that the Chinese were too small in stature and wouldn't be able to handle the grueling, back-breaking work of breaking up the Sierra Mountains. So there was a resistance to hiring the Chinese. So the first Chinese were actually in the area where the Central Pacific was starting, up in Auburn. So they were already there. They were hired. They were paid $30 a month in gold. They were paid in groups. So there are no very few individual Chinese railroad workers on the payroll, even though there are, because there were 12,000, there are many, many pages of the payroll sheets. And they weren't their full names weren't recorded. They were recorded as Ah Fong or Ah Chu or Jim King. So that's part of the reason it's so difficult to document who these workers were.
Those were mainly the labor contractors. So the labor contractors then hired the workers. So the thousands of the workers, we don't know their names. The names that do appear on the railroad payroll records are most likely those of the contractors. I would just mention about the strike. It's telling what the demands were. And it goes back to your question about how desirable this job was. The demands, as we know from the company, because the company was quite upset about this labor stoppage, the demands included the freedom to be able to leave the work, improvement in pay and living conditions, and also stopping corporal punishment, no beatings. And the company, even after 1 or 2 days, became so concerned about this, the consequences of the strike, they began to think about alternative sources of labor, which included recruiting freed people from the Deep South.
Russell Lowe, how much have you been able to recover from your own plumbing into the depths of your family history?
Well, the family history is quite extensive. You know, trying to actually find artifacts from my great-grandparents is difficult. We have a few things, probably. But, you know, I think one of the important points that we like to make is that the real legacy of people like Hung Lai Wo isn't probably in the artifact. It's really in the generations of people that he left behind. There are now, 150 years later, over 100 descendants of the railroad worker and his wife. And I think that's really where the legacy is. And now we have people that were the first graduates from UC Berkeley in engineering Chinese. We have his daughter who studied at Juilliard and performed in the Flower Drum Song. You know, we have World War II heroes. So I think that's kind of where we like to see the real outcome and the real legacy of these people.
Could you say something, too, since I know you've done a lot of digging around, Russell, about the women? I mean, do the men mainly come alone or do they marry? And if the women came, what kind of work did they do?
That's fascinating, and it's fascinating because if you look at the descendants and you try to figure out, well, how is it that these Chinese railroad workers were able to have families here? Well, what we found when we started talking to each other is that a lot of these women were brought here as slaves. They were brought here basically against their will. My great-grandmother was named Tom Ying, and she was brought here as a 9-year-old girl as a servant girl, and she was what they called the Musai. Against her will, she probably was sold by her family. She had to work perhaps for a wealthy Chinese merchant family, and they likely did not treat her well. She fortunately was rescued by missionaries in San Francisco. She went to live at what ultimately would become the Cameron House. Then it was the Presbytery Mission Home. She was rescued. She lived there for several years. And my great-grandfather was able to meet her there. And I think it's that really compelling story of how these two people overcame tremendous hardship. And on one hand, a young boy who worked on the railroad up in the harsh Sierra Nevadas, and on the other hand, his wife, who was brought here as a slave and rescued. I think it's that legacy that we're sort of living today.
Let me bring some of our callers into this, and Michael, you're up first. Join us. You're on the air. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes. It's an interesting story. My great-grandfather also worked on the railroad, and he went back to China and with the money he made, you know, lived a life of a merchant, was able to live a better life than when he left. But the legacy is that he sent his youngest son, which was my grandfather, back to America. He told him, this is where you're going to make your fortune. But my grandfather was a paper citizen. He had to buy papers in order to get him back here. Well, if it weren't for that, I don't think we would be in America. My dad worked on the Stanford Linear Accelerator at Stanford, and when he retired, they sent somebody to interview him, and he said that, you know, my granddad worked for Stanford as a coolie building the railroad, and, you know, 80 years later, his grandson is still working for Stanford.
Yeah, well, with the linear accelerator, I like that story. Thank you much for that, Michael. Still working for Stanford, though. Let me go to Hercules next. Steve, join us. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, local historian here, and I got the contact information. We do have a couple of artifacts and some documentation, but it is really, you're right, it's really difficult to get any documentation or any primary sources at all about the contribution of the Chinese. After the Transcontinental finished, there was a rush into all the industries in the Bay Area in California, including the explosives industry, which is very important. Tunnel number 6 would not have been completed without nitroglycerin, which was, at the time, an advanced technology. Does the scope of your study include a look at the number and sources of Chinese workers that worked in industries such as explosives through 1916, when the Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed?
Gordon Chang.
Well, the act wasn't repealed until 1943. But that's a great question about explosive industry, and we'd love to get more information. And please email us with your contact information so we can be in touch. But the railroad, constructing the railroad is one part of the story, the core of the story. But there are all these attendant issues, such as the explosive industry, the lumber industry, because somebody had to make all the—
I'm looking at an email here about the salmon industry and the integral role that Chinese labor played in that.
Later on. And just on the railroad, someone had the railroad ties. It was just up in Guerneville over the weekend, and the Guerneville was a center of railroad tie production, and there were Chinese who were living up there. So even if they weren't working right on their line, there were Chinese working in the lumber industry. Or in masonry, or in all sorts of attendant to food processing, bringing the food over from China. We know that most of the food that they ate, much of the food that they ate up in the Sierras was brought over from China. So there's a very interesting issue of commerce and transportation as well as manufacturing and construction.
And Steve, thank you for your call. Good to hear from you. Let me just read this email about the salmon industry. Scott writes, not widely known, is that Chinese labor was also essential to the early salmon canning industry in Alaska as it developed in the late 19th century. They were brought in to do the really nasty work of decapitating and eviscerating the fish. That job was made obsolete about a century ago when a machine was developed that did the job. The machines were called iron chinks, and I was told that that was a reference to the pejorative word by which the Chinese were known. Those machines were still in use and still called that when I was there as a radio operator in Bristol Bay in the 1960s. And talk about Chinese phrases. Here's Steve with one for us. Steve, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the air.
Welcome.
Yes, there's a phrase called he doesn't have a Chinaman's chance that came from the work that the Chinese laborers did on the Transcontinental Railroad. As the other caller said, they used a form of dynamite that was very unstable, which was nitroglycerin. And so the stable form was invented in 1867, but they were lowered in baskets because they were small, and put dynamite into the sides of cliffs. And the white workers who were, of course, that's very dangerous, but the white workers who were in charge of pulling them up, sometimes they were a little bit, well, let's say they weren't motivated to pull up so fast, and so the dynamite would blow them out and kill them. And so the Chinese workers protested and wanted to pull up their own, so they at least they'd have a better chance. But that's where the phrase "China doesn't have a Chinaman's chance" came from.
Yeah, never heard that before. Have either of you?
Well, can we come on about the baskets? They were all, as any historical topic, there are many facts and there are myths. And one of the issues that's come up repeatedly is this image of Chinese being lowered in baskets down the side of cliffs to be able to hammer our way at the side of these cliffs. They're
pretty big baskets, even though.
Yeah. And then there are even paintings, you know, that sort of illustrate this. And then there's descriptions of this in latter descriptions of the building of the railroad. But we went back to look to see if there's any truth in this, and we're now come to the opinion that this did not happen. They were not lowered in baskets. It's just there was no eyewitness accounts at the time, and also physically, it doesn't make sense that you can't really chip away at a granite cliff in a basket, because if you hit away with a chisel and a hammer, you'd be bouncing around on the side of the cliff, and the cliffs are not shaped in a way that would facilitate or allow for this. But now we think that they were lowered in bosun's chairs or something of this sort, where they could use their feet to sort of stabilize themselves, and it's still horrible work. But the idea of the baskets is comes up repeatedly. It's a great story, and when I went into this project, I hoped it was true. But now I've come to the belief.
Let me tell you, that's what made them basket cases, or something like that.
It's really very dangerous. A lot of dynamite being thrown around, as Calder said too. They had wars with each other.
Well, here's something that may not be part of mythology. A caller called in to say the Chinese got sick less because they boiled their water for tea. In terms of, you know, the kind of dietary problems that may have been attendant to many others who were working there, or the foreman and so forth. Connie Young Yu is a descendant of a Chinese railroad worker, also the author of a book called Chinatown, San Jose, USA, and she's helped conduct oral histories of descendants for the Stanford Project. We have her on the line here. Connie Young Yu, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. And you have a family story that I guess fits into that whole pattern of what may or may not be mythology. It's about a $20 gold coin.
Oh, yes. My great-grandfather, Lee Wong Sang, came from a Toisan village in 1866. And he worked on the Central Pacific, and he became a foreman. And this is all told through oral history, which I find incredibly credible.
Wait a minute, became a foreman because he knew enough English to be a foreman?
Yes, he did learn English, and I have seen his handwriting in English in the archives of, you know, the National Archives, in testifying for his sons who went back and forth to China. He had to, and he would sign his name, and also his signatures on his son's birth certificate, my grandfather's birth certificate from 1870. I see Lee Wong Sang written in English. So, but anyway, the story is, and this was passed down from his widow, that's my great-grandmother, to the daughter-in-law, my grandmother, to my mother, who told it to me, and as an example of how hard he worked and how hard the fact that we came from laboring stock. You know, we worked on our ancestors worked on the iron road. And so my great-grandfather, Lee Wong Sang, had accumulated from his wages, his first month, enough for a gold coin that he carried around for luck. So he carried around this for months, and he did work in the Sierra Lines. According to oral history, it was in very, very cold, snowy country. And one night he went to the latrine, and then when he came out, he had found he had lost his gold coin. And he searched for it for quite a while, and he said he wept over this lost coin for weeks. So that's the story of a lost coin. He did not describe the work that he did, or the conditions, or you know what happened to him, but the loss of this coin.
Well, that stayed in your family for generations, that story, obviously, and they were paid, we heard, $20, so maybe you just took that pay for that kind of work and turned it into a gold coin. I'm wondering, I asked Russell Lowe this question, I'll ask you the same, the source of this study of your own family history in terms of your pride.
Oh, yes. Well, the railroad symbolized a lot in our family. It was called the Iron Road, and the fact that my great-grandfather worked on the railroad, you know, for a dollar a day and was part of this huge American enterprise, you know, always gave us pride that we were part of building America, that we had ancestors who were part of building America. And then, on the other hand, my mother said, you know, the railroad gave us a foothold in America because my great-grandfather was able to send money back and, you know, build up one of the railroad villages in Toisan. And he was able to become a merchant, which enabled him to have a family, to send for his wife, to have my grandfather, who became a successful merchant, to raise a family. And that's how, you know, my mother was there, you know, to tell these stories, and it's a tremendous source of pride. And last year, because of all this interest, and largely because of the Stanford Project and Chinese Historical Society, the Department of Labor in Washington, D.C., in May of last year, honored Chinese railroad workers in the Hall of Honor. And I was there with a group of descendants. I was representing the descendants, and we all spoke with such incredible pride of our past, but also the fact that for the first time, the federal government recognized Chinese labor.
And let's give a little bit of a prop here to Deputy Secretary of Labor Christopher Liu, who had, I think, a good deal to do with that event that you just referenced. And again, Connie Young Yu with us by phone, descendant of a Chinese railroad worker and also author of Chinatown, San Jose, USA. And she has conducted oral histories of descendants for the Stanford Project, which is certainly what our focus is on to a great deal here, a project, in conjunction with the Chinese Historical Society of America and with Chinese scholars as well in China. I'm looking at a tweet here from a listener named Carl. It says, be sure the Chinese rail workers are part of American history, not marginalized as the Chinese story. Thank you for that. I think we've been saying that. And this is an email that I'm going to ask you about, Gordon. This is a listener who says, I visited the Kanner Museum at Stanford yesterday. None of Stanford's railroad history was translated into simplified Chinese. I would estimate more than 60% of the visitors to the Kanner Center yesterday were ethnic Chinese. And why haven't translations been posted for these foreign visitors? I saw groups walking right by the gold and silver spikes photos. I've made similar visits to the Railroad Museum in Sacramento. No translations of exhibits. No Chinese translation of the website. This would take 5 to 10 days to complete, perhaps for free.
That's a great question. And I think we should send that question on to those who are responsible for such things at Stanford and other places. But it does bring out this interesting issue that now there are, 1 to 2 million Chinese who are visiting the United States every year. The United States is a big tourist destination for Chinese. And many of them have a great deal of interest in the railroad. And they've heard about this. And they're ignorant about the railroad history themselves. And now they've sort of gotten the bug in China, which has affected the scholars over there, but also everyday people who are now keenly interested in this early history of America-China relations.
We'll bring in more of your calls. We go next to Tom. Tom, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if we could hear a little bit more discussion from the panel about not only the official violence on the railroad in the shop with the corporal punishment, but perhaps a little more discussion on the unofficial violence in the form of neighborhood raids and the American Workers Union movement, the regular raids into Chinatown and the beating, a bit like Tulsa, Oklahoma type raids, and how that eventually led to the Chinese Exclusion Act from the fervor of the working class reaction.
Yeah, Su Lee.
Well, you know, we know that there were huge numbers of Chinese in California. They worked on the railroad, and then after the railroad, they settled into towns. And those towns were many of those towns drove out the Chinese communities. And so that's the violence that you're alluding to, because Chinese were seen as a threat to the local economy.
And to taking jobs away.
And I mean, exactly.
It was a lot of xenophobia, but mainly often about labor and jobs. Do we know anything, Sue or Gordon, about how workers – a listener wants to know, were these jobs advertising? And were the advertising accurate?
Yes, there was advertising. We have newspapers that have the text in Chinese and in English. So they were active recruiters. There were companies that made money off of such recruiting. So this was a very big business. I should say that one of the interesting sort of ironies about this history is that the elite of California were in some sense the Chinese workers' friends. Leland Stanford, Charles Crocker, Hollister, who founds Hollister, the city of Hollister, many of them. And they write in glowing terms about the qualities and abilities of the Chinese. Mark Twain wrote about the Chinese in very favorable terms.
And so did Bret Harte.
And Bret Harte. And Mark Twain talked about how all the Chinese he met were literate. I mean, this is another kind of impression that we have. All the Chinese were illiterate. But now we're thinking that we're revising that story.
Well, good luck with the project. It's an exciting one. Again, how can I get in touch with the project, people who have information?
Chinese Railroad Workers, Stanford, search for that, and then you'll get a link to us.
Okay. Again, good fortune with it, discovering, well, a lost history in many respects, but one that needs to be found. Thank you, Gordon Chang. Gordon Chang's professor of history and humanities and directs the Center for East Asian Studies at Stanford. He also co-directs the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America project. Sue Lee is executive director of the Chinese Historical Society of America. And we also had two descendants of Chinese railroad workers, Russell Lowe and Connie Young Yu. We thank all of you. And this discussion, by the way, can be continued by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Can you quickly tell us, Gordon, how many actually died? Do we know?
We don't know. They didn't. Railroad company didn't. Some up to 1,200, maybe 1,500 is the number.
I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.